Okay, so to pick up where we left off, the idea is now to write down the Lagrangian for the standard model. And you know, the goal is to, again, the goal this week is to complete the review of the standard model and review its puzzles and also review the associated puzzles in the standard model of cosmology. And then also, you know, meet what we know our most sure hint about beyond the standard model physics is from the neutrino sector, and so we want to get some understanding of that also by the end of the week, so that that's the idea, hopefully, is that then the next 2 weeks will be more about proposals and ideas for resolving those puzzles and genuine proposals for beyond the standard model physics, even beyond neutrinos. Okay, so to remind you, last time we reviewed Yang-Mills theory. By the way, it came to my attention that last time, somehow when I was reviewing Yang-Mills theory, I kept saying, I hope I didn't confuse everyone, but I was talking about GR, and I was saying GR is all about the tangent space over a given point in the manifold, and the collection of tangent spaces, namely the tangent bundle and the curvature and connection on that tangent bundle. And then I said, whereas Yang-Mills is about, well, now the matter fields live in a different vector space whose dimension is not necessarily equal to the manifold dimension. And I said, you know, so we pick a gauge group and we pick a representation, and the representation is some n by n matrix. And then I think I kept saying for some reason that then the vector space is also n by n dimensional. So I hope I think I said that a number of times at the beginning of the lecture, so I hope I didn't confuse people with that. I occasionally just think one thing and say the other. And so when the representation matrices are n dimensional, the representation matrices are n by n matrices, the vector space in which they act is, of course, n-dimensional. So this is just normal matrix action on some vector space. Okay, so just wanted to make sure. I apologize if I left anyone confused during last lecture because of that. But hopefully not. So again, so step one, we want to specify the gauge group, pick a gauge group. And so for the standard model, we're going to pick SU3 times SU2 times U1. Okay, and then step two, there's really only two steps in defining a Yang-Mills theory. Step one, you pick the gauge group. Step two, you have to pick the representation of that gauge group. In other words, the representation under which the matter fields, all the fields other than the gauge fields, transform. Okay, so in the standard model, we saw that was sort of summarized by a little table. Didn't give my table enough room. I want to redo my table because I'm going to keep looking at it. Redo. So the table. Okay. Components of the gauge group along the top, SU3, U2, SU2, and U1. The fermion and scalar fields along this axis. So we have the left-handed quark doublet Q sub L. And again, I remind you that or soon after spontaneous symmetry breaking, this you often rethink of this thing as U left and D left, the up quark, left-handed up quark and left-handed down quark. But anyway, in terms of the irreducible representation, they're both in the same SU2 doublet, so there's just one field here. The left-handed quark doublet, the corresponding right-handed up quark, corresponding right-handed down quark, and then that's the quark structure, and then there's the analogous structure in the lepton sector. Instead of a quark doublet, instead of a left-handed quark doublet, there's a left-handed lepton doublet, which again, after spontaneous symmetry breaking, we'll have this reinterpretation as the left-handed neutrino and the left-handed electron. And then there's the corresponding right-handed neutrino and right-handed electron. But again, really in the standard model, the traditional standard model, there is no right-handed neutrino. And for clarity's sake, for sort of conceptual clarity for what we'll be describing later in the week, it's good to, even though I think that it's more likely than not that that line is there, let's leave that out in our description of the traditional standard model so that we can be clear about what the motivation is for including it and what the possibility is for not including it. Okay, so then those are all the fermion fields. And then there's just the scalar fields. Well, there's only one, apparently, in the standard model, and that's the Higgs. Okay, so, and then again, the quarks are the fields here that transform as triplets under SU3. In other words, they actually transform. Everything else doesn't transform, which has this confusing notation that it's one, which again just means that it's the one-dimensional or trivial representation of SU3, the one that doesn't transform. The left-handed fields in the standard model do transform under SU2 in the fundamental two-dimensional representation. The remaining fermion fields, the right-handed ones, don't, but the Higgs does. And then we'll get to these later, but there's this sort of weird hodgepodge of charge assignments. People often call this SU3 color, SU3C. So the three different components of this vector are referred to as three colors, red, green, and blue. Here, this is often called SU2 weak or SU2 left, referring to the fact that it only acts on the left-handed fermions. And then this one is often called U1Y, where Y is the conventional term for the hypercharge. That's to distinguish it from U1Q, which is the conventional notation for the normal electric charge. This thing is related after spontaneous symmetry breaking to the electric charge, but we'll get there. Okay, so anyway, there's this continuing our list here. I'm finding this chalk hard to read. Is this legible I'm writing? Yes. Okay, I'm just having a stroke or something. Okay, so fine. Now, so our job now, those are the fields, and again, really, this is not a field yet. So our job is to take those fields and write down every term we can think of, satisfying the properties that, well, we're going to write down the renormalizable part of the standard model Lagrangian. That's what's traditionally meant by the standard model. Or in other words, from an effective field theory standpoint, those are the terms that you expect to be relevant or marginally relevant at low energies. So we're going to write down all of the operators if we sum up the dimensions of all the fields, their mass dimension is less than or equal to space-time dimension, which is 4. And then we also want to be Lorentz invariant. Well, really also translationally invariant, but that'll happen trivially. But so we want them to be Lorentz invariant. And SU3 times SU2 times U1 invariant. So in other words, what this means is that these fields, they all carry some Lorentz indices and some SU3 and SU2 and U1 indices. Well, the U1 is not really an index, but anyway, they carry some U1 charge. And so just like in GR, if you're trying to make something Lorentz invariant, you know, you combine tensors and you contract upper and lower indices, and if there's any hanging indices left over, that's not an invariant quantity. The invariant quantities are the things where all the indices are contracted in pairs so that there's no indices left over. Well, that's still the condition that we want. We want terms that have no hanging Lorentz indices. That'll make sure they're Lorentz invariant. But we also want to make sure there's no hanging SU3 times SU2 times U1, SU3 times SU2 indices or U1 charges. That will ensure that the terms are invariant under that gauge group. Okay, so now just as a, let's start. So let's start trying to write down the terms. So let's begin by thinking about the kinetic terms. So you know we have three types of part. We're going to have three types of particles here. So again, to make the world gauge invariant under these three gauge groups, we're going to be forced to introduce three corresponding gauge fields, which I'll call G mu for the gluon field or the gauge field associated with the strong force, W mu for the weak gauge field or the gauge field associated with SU2, and for some reason B mu is the conventional notation for the gauge field associated with hypercharge Y. So, okay, so those are our three spin one fields that we have to work with. And then we have these spin one half fields and this spin zero field. So let's first just try to write down the kinetic terms for all of those fields. Let's start with the gauge fields. So remember the story last time was we were led, the partial derivative couldn't be used to make a good kinetic term because it didn't transform properly. So instead we introduced this covariant derivative term. Okay, so now when we're really just going to do the same thing here, but because our gauge group is really just a product of three simple groups, the corresponding gauge field is just the sum of the corresponding gauge fields for those three parts. So the covariant derivative in the standard model will look like this. Okay, so in other words, it's the partial derivative plus I times G3, the coupling constant for SU3, times this gauge field, which is really over each point in space-time, this is a 3x3 traceless Hermitian matrix. And then plus I times G2, the gauge coupling for SU2, which can be different, times W mu, which is a 2x2 traceless Hermitian matrix over each point in space-time. And then plus IG1, the coupling constant for U1, hypercharge, times B mu, which is just a real number, real valued field over every point in space-time. It's a 1x1 Hermitian matrix. Okay. Now let me use this notation that I'll denote an element, and what I'm about to write, I'll denote an element of SU3. I'll denote an element of the, you know, we're going to represent SU3 as some matrix. I'll denote the matrix representative of it by U3. And similarly for SU2, I'll denote the matrix representative by U2. And for, similarly for U1, I'll denote it by U1. Okay, so now, so recall that in order to make this thing covariant, we learned last time that the gauge field had to transform under a gauge transformation in this particular way. U A mu U inverse plus I over the gauge coupling times the partial of U times U inverse. Okay, so there will be an analogous transformation law for each of these gauge fields. So for example, G mu will transform to U3 G mu U3 inverse plus I over the G3 gauge coupling, the SU3 gauge coupling, times partial sub mu of U3 times U3 inverse. And then there's an analogous formula for W mu. You know, it would transform to U2 W mu U2 inverse plus I over G2 D mu U2 U2 inverse. And analogously for B mu, okay? So then recall that, okay, this guy, so far this thing, it's okay as long as you use it together with a partial derivative, but on its own it's no good. It doesn't transform like a tensor yet. It has this tensorial part plus this extra inhomogeneous part, which we don't want to use directly without combining it without combining it as part of a covariant derivative. But if we calculated the associated curvature, we got this formula. The associated curvature is given by d mu a nu minus d nu a mu plus I times the gauge coupling times the commutator of a mu and a nu. Remember, these are matrix valued fields, so that's what we mean when we're taking the commutator of those matrices. So in this case, in the standard model, we'll just have an analogous expression for each of the gauge fields. So if we just follow the exact same logic that led us to this expression, but we apply it now to this more complicated expression for the covariant derivative with three pieces, then we'll find that, for example, associated with the gauge field G mu, there's a field strength or a curvature G mu nu. So the only distinction notationally I'm using now between the gauge field and the field strength is just that the gauge field has one index and the field strength has two indices. So g mu nu is equal now to d mu of g nu minus d nu of g mu plus I times the SU3 gauge coupling, G3, is the commutator of g mu with G nu. And again, we would have an analogous expression for the field strength, the SU2 field. So that's the SU3 field strength. The SU2 field strength would be W mu nu equals partial mu of W nu minus partial nu of W mu plus I times G2, the SU2 gauge coupling, times the commutator of W mu and W nu. And similarly, so there would be an analogous expression for W mu nu here. And an analogous expression for B mu nu. Okay, and just like this guy, we found transformed as nicely under a gauge transformation. So this guy transformed, recall, as U F mu nu as U inverse. Similarly, this guy, each of these guys has the analogous transformation law. G mu nu transforms as now tensorially with respect to, so it now transforms as U3 times G mu nu, U3 inverse, and et cetera for the other two. Okay, so that means that we can go ahead and write down the kinetic term for these guys. Well, you know, again, remember, the kinetic term for ordinary electromagnetism, for just ordinary Maxwell theory, is minus 1/4 F mu nu, F mu nu. And we saw last time that all we had to do to convert this into the kinetic term for Yang-Mills theory was to just put this whole thing inside a trace. And so the kinetic term for the standard model will just be a sum of these terms, one for each of the pieces of the gauge group, SU3, SU2, and U1. So it'll be minus 1/4 trace G mu nu, minus 1/4 trace W mu nu, minus 1/4 trace B mu nu. Now really this field isn't even a matrix, so the trace is actually just redundant there. I've just included that to make the parallelism clear. But anyway, so that's the kinetic term for the gauge bosons. So let's now talk about, well, now the scalar fields. Well, there's only one scalar field, but so anyway, the kinetic term for the scalar field for the Higgs doublet is easily handled. So if we have an ordinary complex scalar field, you may recall from your QFT course that the kinetic term for that would be d mu h dagger contracted with d mu h. And now if the symmetries listed in this table were global symmetries, that would be good enough because, you know, so that term would also be U1 invariant because under a U1 transformation, this guy would transform, if H transforms to E to the, each field transforms to E to the I times its charge, it's U1 charge, which in the case of, which according to this table is a half. So it transforms as E to the I times a half times alpha times H. Okay, so H transforms to E to the I alpha over 2, but H dagger here would transform like E to the minus I H, E to the minus I alpha over 2. So those two phases would cancel, so this term would be invariant under U1, or stated more conveniently, this term has charge plus a half, this term has charge minus a half, those cancel. Also under SU2, if this was imagine that this was a global symmetry, so the SU2 matrices didn't depend on X, let me not even say it that way. The point is now let's. I will say it that way. So if the SU2 transformation didn't depend on X, well, this term would under a transformation it would just get hit by a 2x2 SU2 matrix U2. So a U2 would get inserted in front of there. Okay, but if H goes to U2H under an SU2 transformation, then H dagger goes to H dagger. If H goes to U2H, then H dagger, just take the dagger of this expression, H dagger goes to H dagger, U2 dagger. So in other words, under an SU2 transformation, this term would go to itself, but in front of this, there would be a U2. In front of this, there would be a U2 dagger. They would cancel. And so the term would be invariant. Okay, and so now the only thing that we need to do to make it actually covariant under everything is to just take into account, you know, adjust it so that even when the U2 transformation depends on the space-time coordinate, even when it becomes a local gauge transformation, the term is still invariant. And again, the whole point of the last lecture was that we do that by introducing a covariant derivative, by replacing the partial derivatives with just the covariant derivative. Okay, so that's the kinetic term for the scalar fields in the standard model. So now let's just do the kinetic term for the fermion fields.
Maybe I'm wrong here, but in the covariant derivative, don't you need to put a charge as well to cancel with?
Yeah, that's a very good question. So I was going to discuss that a little bit more later, but yeah. So this expression is actually right, but you're right that it is not the way that term is conventionally written. So really, maybe I'll get back to this question if that's okay, because what happens is that, you know, what d mu acts on each field depends on what representation that field lives in. So, and indeed, one way to write a way to write that makes b mu be the same b mu for every different field is to pull the q out explicitly in front of it. So indeed, that will be true. But let me come back to that, because you're absolutely right. So indeed, the notation that we'll use for the rest of the course. Okay, let's do an example. That's a good point.
I have another quick question as well.
Yeah.
What metric signature?
Oh yeah, so I am usually using, I use minus plus plus plus. Which is why I have a minus sign in front of my scalar field kinetic term there. So if you think about it, that means that the term with the time derivatives, the term that's h dot times h dot, has a plus sign in front of it, which is what you usually want for the field to be not a ghost. So yeah, good. Okay, yeah, but let's now that you mention it, let's do. So it's true that whenever this d mu acts on a particular field, it will care about what it. Remember, we were working out last time the covariant derivative acting on a particular representation. So that d mu will care about what representation it is acting on. It'll look different depending on what field it is acting on here. So for example, if we look at Q left, then d mu acting on it will be partial. Now, because Q left is the three-dimensional representation of SU, it lives in the three-dimensional representation of SU3, the g mu there will be the 3x3 representation of the, will live in the 3x3 representation of the, of SU3. Okay, so that'll be a 3x3 matrix. Under SU2, this guy lives in the two-dimensional representation of SU2, so G2 will be, W mu will be in the 2x2 representation of SU2. It'll be a 2x2 Hermitian matrix, traceless. And then, as you just pointed out, indeed here B mu will be in the charge 1/6 representation. But since B mu is going to be appearing all over the Lagrangian, and it's more convenient, and anyway, it's conventional to write it in a form that, and we just want to write, yeah. So, for good reason, you have pointed out that in the U1 case, what you do is you pull out that representation dependence in front and write the charge explicitly. So in this case, we would write 1/6 times B mu, acting on Q left. Okay, let's just do another example just to see how things would change. Suppose this was U right. What would change? Well, since U right is still in the three-dimensional representation of SU3, nothing would change here. But since it's trivial under SU2, this would be this would be Lie algebra valued. This would be in the trivial representation of SU2. In other words, the representation that when you exponentiate it always gives the identity matrix. Well, the exponential of 0 gives the identity matrix. So this the representation of the Lie algebra in the trivial representation is just 0. So this term would go away. And finally, because the charge here would be plus 2/3, this thing would become 2/3. Okay, and so whenever we're writing down, so that's thank you for having me do that, because otherwise I was going to confuse everybody. So whenever we're writing down covariant derivative operators acting on some field, this is what is meant. You always have to modify the covariant derivative operator appropriately for whatever field that it's acting on. Okay, good. So the fermion kinetic terms. Remember that the kinetic term for an ordinary fermion field is something like this. This is the Dirac Lagrangian, the kinetic term for the Dirac Lagrangian. Okay, I psi bar d slash psi. And you know, really, this could even be a different fermion here. I mean, this could be chi, and that would still be Lorentz invariant. You know, the key point about the Dirac Lagrangian is Dirac found this form where if you take the spinner index of this guy, contract it with the spinner index, the first spin, so this. If we write out del slash more fully. So this guy has a spinner index alpha. Gamma mu is a matrix with two spinner indices, alpha and beta. And then psi bar has a spinner index. And these spinner indices are contracted up in a way where nothing is left hanging over. This thing is Lorentz invariant. Okay. So now we just have to make sure that it's also gauge invariant. We have to write down terms of that kind of form, but make sure they're also gauge invariant. Okay, so let's take an example. What possible terms can we write down? Well, suppose we tried to write down a term involving the partial of Q left. Let's look at the first fermion. Well, the first thing is that we've learned our lesson now. If it's going to be gauge invariant at the end of the day, this should be capital D slash. So in other words, gamma mu contracted with the covariant derivative. And so then we want to put some fermion bar here. And what can we put? Well, so this guy has an SU3 index. And D times it has an SU3 index. So we have to put something over here that has a 3-bar index. So this whole thing is going to transform into U3 times D slash QL under a SU3 transformation. So we better put something here that transforms into whatever fermion we put here, psi bar, had better transform into psi bar times U3 dagger under an SU3 transformation so that these guys will cancel. So in other words, psi had better be a 3 also. Whatever representation, SU3 representation this was, this has to be the same thing. So it's got to be one of the quarks. As long as we put a quark there, we'll have an SU3 invariant object. But, you know, what about SU2 invariants? This thing has an SU2 index. So by a similar argument, we'd better have this fermion also be a 2 under SU2. The only thing that's both a 3 and a 3, yeah, the only thing that has both those properties on this list is QL itself. So we have to write down here, we have no choice, we got to write that. Okay, and then, if you check that this thing is also U1 invariant because this one picks up a phase, this one picks up exactly e to the minus that phase. This is an invariant term. It's Lorentz invariant, it's gauge invariant. And by a similar line of reasoning, you convince yourself that every fermion on the list just has a kinetic term just like that. Okay, so the only thing we can write down exactly that argument is one kinetic term for every guy on the list. Okay, so far so good. Well, actually, so this is going to be the right kinetic term for the fermions. And let's just say there's something that you might say. Well, what about what kept me? You know, remember that an important, you know, we're supposed to be meeting the various mysteries of the standard model and. Everything about that table is a mystery, but one of the most glaring mysteries, is that there's three copies of every field in every fermion field in this table. So in addition to the right-handed electron, there's the right-handed muon and the right-handed tau. In addition to the right-handed down quark, there's the right-handed strange quark and the right-handed bottom quark that don't differ at all in terms of their charges. They only differ in terms of their, well, we'll see what they differ in terms of. But they don't differ in terms of their charges. So what's to stop me? So secretly, when I wrote down this kinetic term, what I really wrote down was I was imagining it was diagonal so that whatever index this guy had, whatever family index this guy had the same one. Okay, so in other words, an up quark only is coupled to an up quark. A charm quark is only coupled to a charm quark. A top is only coupled to a top. But why is that? I mean, what's to stop me from writing down a term that's like UR bar times D slash times CR? In other words, first generation UR times second generation UR. Maybe I should write that. And more generally, why? Well, nothing's to stop me from writing that down. I can write that down. That's perfectly Lorentz invariant and gauge invariant. I mean, more generally, I should start by writing down every term. Okay, and contracting the whole thing with, you know, every term can in principle have, there's no symmetry acting, as far as we know, there's no symmetry acting on the family indices. So every term here can have an independent complex number, K, I, J, in front of it. So in other words, naively, it looks like we have to write down an arbitrary 3x3 complex matrix in front of this, matrix of constants. So the reason that we don't end up having to do that is that, well, so first of all, every time you write down any term in the Lagrangian, there's one condition I forgot to mention on my list before, which is that it's not enough to be dimension less than or equal to 4, Lorentz invariant, and Gauge invariant. The Lagrangian has to be real, it has to be Hermitian. So I have to add this term plus its Hermitian conjugate. Well, so that ends up meaning that this can't be an arbitrary matrix, it's an arbitrary Hermitian matrix. So I can take an arbitrary Hermitian matrix and I can diagonalize it. Okay. Where U is a unitary and lambda is real diagonal. And then I can just absorb, I can do a field redefinition where I just redefine U right prime is equal to lambda to the 1/2 U inverse U right. And that transforms it into this diagonal form here. So without loss of generality, indeed I can take this thing. Okay, so that's all the kinetic terms in the standard model. So what are we missing? Oh, you know what? This is a great time. I didn't forget today. I have Pez. I thought Pez would be good because I can load it, you know. It involves no like sharing of, we're not gonna like spread a disease around the room here because I can load it without touching the Pez and you guys can all pass it to one another. This is, I think, Rey. You will have Rey from Star Wars. And you over here, and have Dory from Finding Dory. You might pass it around. But the idea, it's a rather small thing, I appreciate. The picture I have is that, in my fantasy about how this will go, each of you will take a Pez if you want one, and then you will just be delighted by it, by your one Pez, and the rest of the lecture will go much better. Okay. So what terms have we missed? What else is there in the standard model? Well, besides the kinetic terms. Well, there's not that much, actually. So the first thing to say, well, let's think about what else can we write down. Well, we, first of all, I remind you, you probably have seen this before, but so you know the action has the same units as h bar. Action and angular momentum have the same dimensions. And we're working in units where h bar is equal to 1. So the action has to be dimensionless. So it is d4x times the Lagrangian. So in units where h bar is equal to c equals 1, length has the same units as 1 over mass. So this has, so the measure here has units of 1 over mass to the fourth. So in order for this to be dimensionless, this has to have units of mass to the fourth. Okay, so, but you know, so if we now look at the, like the normal kinetic term for a scalar field is d mu phi squared. So that has units of, well, d mu, we just said that length has units of 1 over mass. A derivative is 1 over length. D, you know, derivative has units of 1 over length. So it has units of mass. So the derivative has mass dimension 1. Mass dimension 1. And so we have two derivatives plus two scalar fields. Has to add up to mass dimension 4. So the scalar fields, each scalar field has to have mass dimension 1. Okay, so scalar fields, let's say the Higgs in our case, has mass dimension 1. If we instead look at the kinetic term for a fermion field, again, this has to add up to 4. So we have 1 plus the two fermion fields. So the two fermion fields have to add up to 3. So each has to have mass dimension 3/2. And then finally, for the kinetic term for a gauge boson, now remember this is d mu a, so this has a derivative, this has a derivative, so that's two derivatives equals 2, and then two a's also has to equal 2, so each a has to have mass dimension 1. gauge fields have mass dimension. Okay, so then what are our, what are the remaining options that we have to write down with dimension less than 4? And it's something, it's probably something where it's only going to really, the only thing to really do is to sit down by yourself and write it and make sure you agree. But so the first thing to say is that one thing we can do, can we write anything more down with gauge fields? Well, first of all, let's exclude gauge fields that are incorporated into covariant derivatives, because we're already writing those down in different ways. So just with bare gauge fields, well, we don't want to write down bare gauge fields because they don't transform right. With f mu nu, what can we write down with f mu nu besides what we've already done? Well, f mu nu has dimension 2. So once we include one f mu nu, first of all, we need to contract its indices with something. We can't contract its indices with the metric, because the metric is symmetric and f mu nu is anti-symmetric in those Lorentz indices. So that would be 0. So the only thing available to contract those indices with is another f mu nu. So we have to have two f mu nus appearing in any term. But now, to contract up the indices in the ordinary kinetic term, we contracted them up with the metric tensor. So now, with, when we took trace of g mu nu, we contracted the Lorentz indices with the metric tensor, eta mu nu, which is one invariant tensor available to us. Now, there's one other invariant tensor available to us in 4D, which is the totally anti-symmetric tensor with 4 indices. So another term we could write down, another type of term we could write down, is we could write down terms with two field strengths, okay, we could write down these terms. Okay, so the traces make them gauge invariant for the same reason as before. And now Lorentz invariance is achieved in a different way by taking all the Lorentz indices and contracting them with the Lorentz indices on the epsilon tensor. Now it turns out that these are topological terms. Okay, so these are total derivatives if you vary them in the action. You know, if you do the vary them to find their contribution to the Euler-Lagrange equations, you find the contribution is 0. They don't make any contribution to the Euler-Lagrange equations. So classically, these are trivial terms, but quantum mechanically, they are not, or this one is not. So this one, famously, okay, and there's some coefficient, unknown coefficient in front. Let's call the coefficient theta 3, theta 2, theta 1. If theta 3 is non-zero, we'll get back to this, but this term predicts a non-zero electric dipole moment for the neutron, which is not observed. Okay, so experimentally, people have tested the looked for the electric dipole moment of the neutron, and it's stupendously small. So that ends up implying that the coefficient, this dimensionless coefficient, which is for some reason less than 10 to the minus 9. Okay, so it seems to be 0, basically. And we don't know why that is. So that is the fact that this term can be written down, but for some reason does not seem to be there in the standard model, is the so-called strong CP problem. One of the famous puzzles with the standard model. Okay, so what else can we write down? The rest of those terms have make no observable effect. What else can we write down? Well, so now we're done with gauge fields. Apart from including them in covariant derivatives, we're done with building things out of field strengths. So The only fields we have left to work with are fermions, spinner fields, and scalar fields. So there's two options. We can look at terms that don't include spinner fields and terms that do. Let's think first about the ones that don't include spinner fields. So term that doesn't include spinner fields has to, and doesn't include the field strength, all it can be built from is the Higgs. And the only term we can write down involving the Higgs and derivatives is the one we did write down already. So the only thing left to do is to write down potential terms for the Higgs. In other words, terms that only involve the Higgs field itself with no derivatives. Okay, and we can write down two terms like that. First of all, if we just take H dagger H, that has dimension 2, so that's okay. That's dimension less than 4. We just have to put a coupling constant in front of it, some constant which also has dimension 2. So that's the famous Higgs. This is the mass parameter that there's this hierarchy problem in the standard model, which is this thing is at the electroweak scale, which is roughly 10 to the 3 GeV. And it's hard to understand how quantum mechanically it manages to stay so far below the UV cutoff of the theory, which might be the gut scale or the Planck scale. But anyway, so that's the so-called hierarchy problem. Anyway, so that's one term that's one term we can add. And then the only other term we can add is to have a dimensionless coupling lambda times H dagger H squared. Because this thing now has 1, 2 times 2 equals dimension 4. So we can't add any more Higgs fields than this without going above our constraint that the dimension of the field should sum to at most 4. Okay, so this thing is called the Higgs potential. And you'll notice that remember the potential in a Lagrangian is usually kinetic energy minus potential energy, so that's why we're writing this contribution to the Lagrangian is minus the potential, the Higgs potential. And so notice that we've written the sign here so that if we drew this potential, it would, the quadratic term would first curve it down. If we bring this minus sign over, this is minus m squared plus lambda. So in other words, the quadratic term bends down, and then the lambda causes the thing to come back up. And so indeed, I wrote it that way because that is a crucial part of the standard model, is that the Higgs potential is supposed to have this instability so that the vacuum expectation value of H is not at zero, where the full symmetry of the theory would be manifest, but instead it wants to sit at the minimum of the potential at a non-zero value, really the bottom of this potential is, this is what the potential would look like if H was a real valued field, but it's actually valued in a two-component complex vector, so really there's a whole three sphere of degenerate vacua down here. And when the Higgs decides to sit in one particular point in that three sphere, that breaks the symmetry of the theory. Then that's the so-called Higgs mechanism. And anyway, we'll get to that shortly. But okay, so that's the next to last sort of term we can write down. And then the last sort of term we can write down I wrote on a board that doesn't move. Oh well. I'm not a genius with the boards. Okay, so the final thing we can write down are the all-important Yukawa couplings. Okay, and so here we get to do a little exercise that is analogous to the one that we did for the kinetic term here. So, first, let me remind you what when we write a subscript left or right on here, what we're talking about is the chirality of that spinner. So a normal Dirac spinner in four dimensions is a vector with four complex components. But now when we act with the Lorentz group, when we act with Lorentz transformations on this vector, it decomposes into, the representation is reducible. So the bottom two components transform into each other, and the top two components transform into each other, but the top and bottom halves don't mix. So, which is why when we're building our theory, we're free to work with, we can work with fields that are either only have the top two components, so a right-handed field only has non-zero components on top, and then the bottom two components are zero, or a left-handed field, which the top two components are zero and the bottom two components are non-zero. Now, oh, you might ask, okay, so one thing you might try to do is write down a mass term in the standard model. Like normally when you work with a fermion, you can write down a mass term like this, psi bar psi. Now, we can't do that in the standard model, and why? So, well, first of all, if you expanded this thing, so let me expand this thing out and write it as psi dagger gamma zero psi. And then what you'll see is that because, okay, and let me remind you that, so this basis, this so-called, this is the Weyl, this in the Weyl basis, the top two components transform into each other and the bottom two components transform into each other. In that basis, I remind you, you've probably seen this, but in that basis, the Dirac gamma matrices are if you think of them in 2x2 blocks, they're 2x2 block off diagonal. So the upper 2x2 block is zero, the lower 2x2 block is zero, but on the off diagonal blocks, we have sigma mu and sigma mu bar, where sigma mu is this notation for as mu runs from 0, 1, 2, 3. This is either the 2x2 identity matrix or the three poly sigma matrices. And then sigma bar is the same thing, but with minus signs in front of the spatial sigma matrices. Okay, but the point is that it's off diagonal. And so when you expand, you know, if we write psi, if we break it into its two components, psi right and psi left, we'll find that the only non-vanishing bits here are psi left bar times psi right. Sorry, I dropped the N here. Psi left bar times psi right plus psi right bar times psi left. So in other words, a mass term like this, if there's no Dirac operator in the term, we're no longer looking at the kinetic term, so there's no Dirac operator to flip things back. So yeah, I mean, we saw over here, once there's a Dirac operator, that's also off diagonal, so now left fields always talk to left fields, right fields always couple with right fields. But in the mass term, without the Dirac operator, it's the opposite. Left fields always have to talk to right-handed fields. So if you keep in mind that left can only talk to right, and you try to ask, can I write down any pair of fermions from that table, a left-handed fermion and a right-handed fermion, left bar times right, so that the gauge fields, so that the gauge transformations cancel, so that all the SU3 and SU2 and U1 transformations will cancel, the answer is no. So for example, if you tried to write down Q left bar times U right and just write a constant mass in front of that, could you do it? No, this thing would be invariant under SU3, but it wouldn't be invariant under SU2, it wouldn't be invariant under U1, etc. So you just can't write down any term like that. But what you can do is you can save the day by inserting a Higgs into that term. And that's called a Yukawa coupling. Two fermions and a scalar field is called a Yukawa coupling. And so those you can write down. And so here, because I'm basically out of time, I'm going to just write down the ones that are allowed, and I leave it as an exercise to check that these really are the only ones that are allowed. So there's just three that you can write down. You can take the left-handed quark. You can soak up its SU2 index with a Higgs, which also has an SU2 index. And then you can soak up its SU3 index with a right-handed, with a right-handed down quark. Okay, if you check, that thing is invariant under SU3, invariant under SU2, and if you add up all the U1 charges, well, from here in the table, this has charge minus a sixth, plus a half, minus a third, is zero. Okay, so this is invariant under the full gauge group. And in fact, now we could have, we could mix a QL from the ith family with a DR from the jth family. And there's nothing forbidding us from doing that, so we had better allow ourselves to write all of those terms down. So we have to write a matrix of coefficients here, yij. And that's called the D-type Yukawa matrix. That's a 3x3 complex matrix of constants in the standard model. So that's the first term you can write down. Similarly, you can write down another term. So that's the first quark Yukawa you can write down, but there's a second quark Yukawa you can write down. QLI times YIJ up. This is a different 3x3 matrix, because in general, there's no reason these coefficients have to be related to this one. Times H twiddle times U right. Okay, what is H twiddle? H twiddle is just defined to be minus I sigma 2 times H. It turns out that if H transforms like a doublet under SU2, minus I sigma 2 times H star, I should have said. So with most representations, if you take, like if you take the three-dimensional representation of SU3, and you take its complex conjugate, that no longer transforms like the three-dimensional representation of SU3. It transforms like a different representation called the 3-bar. But with SU2, SU2 and its fundamental representation are special. So the two-dimensional representation of SU2, which H transforms under, according to that table, if you take its complex conjugate and you do a little linear transformation in front, minus I times the second Pauli sigma matrix, then it turns out that this new guy also just transforms like a doublet, a 2 under SU2. But because we've taken a complex conjugate, its U1 charge has flipped. So this thing has, it's like we have another object to work with in our table here, which has, so H twiddle would have SU3 charge 1, SU2 charge 2, but hypercharge minus a half. So because of that, we can write down that term. And then finally, the last term we can write down, one lepton term, lepton Yukawa coupling, okay, which has yet another 3x3 Yukawa matrix, the E-type Yukawa matrix, times the Higgs times the right-handed quark. Okay, and so that's it. So there you go. So the standard model consists of, there's a first line, which is those three gauge boson kinetic terms up there. There's a second term, which is all the Higgs terms, so that the Higgs kinetic term there, and the Higgs potential terms, which I covered up with this board, unfortunately. Then there's a third line, which is the kinetic term for the scalar field, for the fermion fields. And then there's a fourth line, which is these Yukawa couplings. And I forgot to mention that you also have to add up the Hermitian conjugates of all of these terms to make the whole thing real. Okay, so that's the standard model. So the only thing that's left for us is in the next lecture is to summarize the puzzles with it. And summarize the physics of, basically, of spontaneous symmetry breaking. Now, to extract the physical content from the theory, we have to replace the Higgs doublet H by its VEV plus a perturbation delta H, which is the observed Higgs boson that they see at the LHC. That's this perturbation. But the VEV is just a constant through space-time. So when we plug it into this Lagrangian, there's a bunch of interesting physics that comes out that's important if we're going to then explain what the remaining puzzles are that I haven't had a chance to touch on yet. Okay, so sorry for running a little bit out.